Everyone's here. Good afternoon, and welcome to the book review presentation at the 8th Annual Boston Book Festival. My name is Paul Makashima, and I'm the book editor of the Boston Globe. The Globe is proud to be a sponsor of the festival, which is not only New England's premier literary event, but one of the nation's best. It celebrates the power of words to stimulate, delight, and inspire. And at the same time, it promotes different cultures and creative ideas and enhances the vibrancy of our city and our region. Tonight will be all about writers and musicians mixing up media and doing eclectic and unexpected things in presentations inspired by their latest work. For instance, Jenna Bell, who has recently released her first EP, Anatomy, will give us a sampling of her blend of folk, soul, R&B, hip-hop, and bluegrass. Richard Russo, whose most recent novel is Everybody's Fool, will grace us with song, because after all, it seemed to work out okay for Dylan, right? And besides, I didn't get a chance to talk to Richard, but I was thinking he's going to be just fine, because no matter how it works out, authentic is cool, right? Faith Saley will serve up pictures and words tied to her memoir, Approval Junkie. Anne Hood's most recent novel is The Book That Matters, and she's going to TED Talk it. And Ben Mezrich, whose latest is The 37th Parallel, quite frankly, we don't know what the hell Ben is doing. But we assume it has something to do with UFOs. And now, without further ado, let me introduce tonight's host, Henriette Lazaridis, founding editor of the audio literary magazine, The Drum, and author of the acclaimed novel, The Clover House. Henriette?
Thank you. Oh wait, I don't need that. Thank you, Paul. Thank you all for coming. Paul stole my joke, but I did want to point out that the Boston Book Festival, we were way ahead of the Nobel Prize Committee, because many months ago, we decided to blend music and literature in this event. And that's because we believe that literature, like music, is always performative. So I want to ask you, how many of you hear the words aloud in your head when you're reading? Raise your hand. Okay, yeah. And how many of you writers in the audience read your work aloud as you're working, as you're revising or writing? Uh-huh. And how many of you, whether you're writers or not, sing in the shower or the car? See, yes. And whether you're doing it for fun or for your art or without even thinking about it, as you read, you're performing. Because we're all always performing words. So to start us off with our performances here today, we have Jenna Bell, who is an Oakland-born, Berklee School of Music-trained singer-songwriter who's performed in numerous places in her current base of New York City, as well as South by Southwest and in Europe. And she has two albums out, Early Bird and the acoustic album Live at Mother. And she has worked with a number of greats in the worlds of folk, soul, R&B, hip-hop, bluegrass, and she counts Paul Simon as one of her mentors. So please welcome Jenna Bell.
How's everyone doing? Good? Cool. I'm gonna play a couple tunes for you. This first one is called Chapter 3, The Hatchet. Thank you. Bearing by a jealous tide, swept away history, genesis of memories of you and I. Once a highway, now a dry lane, stretches beyond breaking dawn. Traces of the pavement with pebbles underneath the lake, and we live on in mere nursery songs. I left roses in the garden, petals on the bed for you. We've lived a belly full, loved a many who couldn't shield us from the arrows pointing to the truth. I left roses in the garden, petals for the funeral room. I pray we'll meet again. I'd rather weep than say that this is how this tale has got to end. So farewell for now, till then. Stood a gold mine, now a coal mine, a gallow girl that's turned to stone, vibrant colored ruby eyes, vacant in a new disguise of emperor's clothes, and arms once open, sense of caving, and rubble born of mountain storms. Oh, patiently I still await for comfort in a woman's embrace, but wind just blows and it's turned me cold. I left roses in the garden, petals on the bed for you. We've lived a belly full, loved a many who couldn't shield us from the arrows pointing to the truth. I left roses in for the funeral. I pray we'll meet again. I'd rather weep than say that this is how this tale has got to end. So farewell for now. Ooh. So I left roses in the garden, petals on the bed for you. We've lived a belly full, loved a many who couldn't shield us from the arrows pointing to the truth. So I left roses in the garden, petals for the funeral. Rather wait than see that this is how this tale has got to end. So farewell for now.
Thank you.
Kind of funny hearing like influenced by hip-hop. I thought you thought
that I was gonna rap. And I was like really worried the minute I started. I was like, no, I won't be doing any rapping today. This next tune is called Phoenix Lights.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful. And time to ask you a question about your songwriting. And I'm interested to know if there's a different quality to the songs that you write from the lyrics up and the songs that you write from the music up.
There's a difference. If I'm writing music up, then there are words implicit in the music. And that takes time to dig out. Whereas if I'm starting from the lyrics down, words are already musical. So it's a matter of rhythm and pace and breath. So
And how does a word give you the melody? How does that, if you're starting from the lyrics and working down?
I kind of believe it's like everything is already there, you know, in a phrase, the sort of lilt and flow of everything that you say has music in it. So it's really just a meditation of like finding melody in that. Mm. And that comes from like having, it's like having a library of words. It's knowing notes and melody and sort of picking them out of the ether.
Well, that's what we're going to discover today in the rest of the evening program or afternoon program, that words have music inherent in them. So thank you very much. Thank you. Jenna Blum, Jenna Bell. And we're first going to hear from Anne Hood, who's going to tell us about her lifelong relationship with books and writing. From childhood to the writing of her most recent novel, The Book That Matters Most, in which, among other things, a book club reads month by month the books that have mattered the most to them, and they all choose classics. It's a great list. Things like 100 Years of Solitude and Pride and Prejudice. Now, but I don't know about you, but I'm not sure that my most important book would be so classy. I might choose something like Encyclopedia Brown or Tootle. Who remembers Tootle? A couple hands. Let's hear it for Tootle the Engine. But you can think about what your book that matters most would be while we're at the book review. And in the meantime, please welcome Anne Hood.
Thank you. Oh God, I want to be a minister now. I love this so much. I can't even tell you. Just completely changed my career. I'm really glad that I decided not to sing. That was so good. Especially since I have the worst voice in the world, perhaps. It's so bad, in fact, that when my son was little, I had never held a baby before, and I didn't know any lullabies. I didn't know anything about children, really. And I didn't even really like them very much, though I liked him a lot. So I used to sing him Joni Mitchell songs. And one day I saw a tape, like an 8-track tape for sale of Joni Mitchell's greatest hits, and I was so excited. I said, wait until you see what I got. And I put it in the tape player, and he said, oh, this woman doesn't know the tunes. So that's when I hung up my singing, thank heavens. Instead, I'm going to talk about a different kind of music, which is the music of language and the magic and music of books. I wrote my new novel, The Book That Matters Most, to celebrate reading. Now, after you've written a novel called The Knitting Circle, you don't rush right into writing one about reading, because I could hear my agent and my editor saying, women knitting, women reading, what's next, women sleeping? You know, you kind of have to have your characters do active things. So this idea has been with me for a long time, but it took a while for me to figure out a way to celebrate books and reading and still have it be kind of active. I started to read when I was 4 years old. No one taught me. I just picked up my older brother's reading book, and I read it. And I still remember the first words. They were, look, look. Everybody's nodding because it was such a good book. My favorite page was later. It was up, up. I loved that one, and I'm serious. But it said, look, exclamation point, look, exclamation point. And I had one thought, I want to live in a book. And at 4 years old, I think that was just me declaring that I wanted to be a reader. But I think in some small way, because it seemed like all my cells kind of settled into place, that I also had the idea planted that maybe I would write books. I lived in a town in Rhode Island that was very economically depressed, and we did not have a library. So I was a kid who loved to read, who had no access to books, except the ones the teachers kept in the back of the classroom. I did love reading the newspaper, even when I was in first grade. My favorite thing to read was Hints from Heloise, in which she told you to do things like save your old onion bags and use them as hair nets, which my mother refused to do, even though I begged her. But when I was in second grade, I got a copy of Little Women, and I fell in love with it. So that would certainly be one of the books that mattered most to me. I remember feeling like, and I bet almost everyone in this room would agree, I wanted to be Jo March. No one wants to be Meg. She's like the worst sister. But I wanted to be Joan March because she wanted to be a writer. I was so lost in the story of the Civil War, the father away, Marmee. I started calling my mother Marmee until she made me stop. They carried baked potatoes in winter to keep the hands warm, which I thought I wanted to do. I was not allowed to. I had to wear my mittens. And then, of course, big spoiler alert, Beth dies in the book. And I was so bereft that I couldn't get through school that day. And my teacher, realizing why I was so sad, offered to let me stay in from recess and just read all the books she had in the classroom. So that was a great gift because she saw a kid who was so hungry for the music of words and stories that she fed me. The next year in third grade, I wrote my first short story after the most popular girl in school, Michelle Kincaid, invited me to her house. She was so popular that she told us the Beatles had written the song Michelle for her. And such was her popularity that we believed her, because who wouldn't write her a song? I lived in an Italian-American immigrant family, classic, many generations, triple-decker, one bathroom, lots of people. I'm great on a road trip. And I really wanted to be American. You know, I wanted to live with Samantha from Bewitched. That was my dream house, and Michelle Kincaid had that house. And so jealous was I after that play date that I went home and wrote my first story. I blamed the fact that we lived where we did, obviously, on my grandmother, Mama Rose, my Italian grandmother. And so in that story, a little girl comes home from school and she magically disappears. And the little girl's life gets so much better. For example, she gets wall-to-wall carpeting, which was one of the things Michelle Kincaid had, and I did not. I went downstairs after writing that story, and I swear to you, such is the power of telling a story, that the world seemed to shift, and everything looked different, even Mama Rose. And for the next few years, I wrote disappearing grandmother stories. I just changed the setting, like Victorian England grandmother, gone, little girl's life gets better. Amazon jungle grandmother, gone, little girl's life gets better. Then in junior high, I wrote stories about the mysteries of girls and friendship. And then in high school, I started writing about the mysteries of love. For example, when Jerry Vadnais took me to see the movie Paper Moon, and then we went to Friendly's, and I thought it was the best date ever, he never asked me out again. So I wrote a short story in which a boy named Jerry got drafted. And my heart was no longer broken. So I understood young the power of story and the power and music of language. I would read when I wanted to escape the world, and I would write when I wanted to figure out the world in which I lived. And that dual sense of comfort got me through most of my life. The hard things, both big and small, but of course as you get older, the hard stuff gets harder and bigger somehow and has a different kind of resonance. That certainly came home for me in 2002 when my five-year-old daughter Grace died suddenly of a virulent form of strep. And in the aftermath of that loss, my brain would no longer process language. And for 2 years, I could not read or write. And let me tell you, it was the 2 years when I needed that magic and that music more than I'd ever needed it in my life. A wise friend suggested that during that time, I learned to knit, which I did, and don't worry, I'm not gonna talk a lot about knitting, though I would love to. I only have 15 minutes, and that takes like a really long time. But for the next 2 years, instead of using language, I knit. And I always say I knit my way through grief. One day, I was walking down the street, and I saw in a wonderful independent bookstore the book, The Number One Ladies Detective Agency. And I had not read a book in 2 years, but for some reason that book called to me. And I bought it, and I went home and read it, crying the entire time. It was the perfect book for me that day. And part of the magic, I think, of books is that they fall into your hands exactly when you need them. Sometimes a friend puts it there. Sometimes you pluck it off a library or bookstore shelf by accident. And sometimes the magic is even more mysterious than that. So when I decided to finally write a book that celebrated reading and books, and to have my main character join a book club at her time of crisis, I asked everybody I knew what was the book that mattered most to them. We did not include children's books, so you would have been out. but had we, I would have had to include Heidi because that was the number one children's book that people said mattered the most. I recorded all of these books in a notebook thinking I was going to have so many choices for my fictional book club to choose, but it became quickly very obvious that the most common 24 answers were books that you've all read that are classics. And I fought that for a long time until I gave in to how marvelous the world is, that there are really books that matter to us that much. That the most popular answer I got was To Kill a Mockingbird, followed by the line, "It's the book that turned me into a reader." I spent a year rereading those top 24 books and choosing the 9 that best reflected the themes and plot of the book that matters most. But I want to confess something to you before you start thinking of your own book that matters most. We are mere humans. We don't have to be heroes like our fictional characters do. Those poor people I created had to choose 1, but I think we all get 5. I think we get the book that mattered most in childhood, like My Beloved Little Women. We get the one that mattered most to us as a teenager, which for me was Marjorie Morningstar. We get the book that mattered to us in college when we became a more serious reader. And for me, that was certainly The Great Gatsby, when I realized the difference between a book like The Great Gatsby and my other favorite book, Princess Daisy by Judith Krantz. We get the book that somehow affected us when we were in our 20s or 30s, which for me was Ann Tyler's Dinner at the Homesick Restaurant, which helped me finish my first novel. And then we get that really magical book, the one that lifts us up when we are at our lowest, that we will never forget because it kind of rescued us, like the number one ladies detective agency did for me. So basically, the book that matters most is the one that is that magical, so special, that when you read it, you remember the day you sat in a chair and opened your brother's reading book and read for the first time those wonderful words, "Look, look." Thank you.
That was great.
Okay, so it wasn't Tootle. I think it was Possession, A.S. Byatt's Possession, that I would have to say, because it made me want to quit academia and be a writer. But I have to say, thank you, Anne, for that talk. That was wonderful. And we're going to hear from Ben Mezrich next. And I have to say, having read his most recent book, I'm here to tell you that you should be glad that we are on the 42nd parallel here in Old South Church and not on the 37th, because, well, unless you're keen to encounter some unidentified flying objects, in which case you'll want to prepare for your trip 5 degrees latitude to the south of us by reading the 37th parallel, The Secret Truth Behind America's UFO Highway. So here to talk about that and other things, perhaps, is Ben Mezrich.
Wow, look at this. This is a great venue. Thank you so much for having me. I love being on the pulpit. It is awesome. It's a lot better than my bar mitzvah was. We didn't have anything like this. I feel like I am looming above you like Trump at a town hall meeting. I had to start with that, sorry. So the 37th parallel is all about UFOs, and I'm going to get to that in a second. I never set out thinking I would ever believe in UFOs. I come from a science-y family. Until a year ago, I was like probably most of you, thinking that the whole UFO phenomenon was crazy people out there in the Midwest seeing strange lights in the sky. For me, you know, I've always come to my stories by accident. I never really set out to be a nonfiction writer at all. I hated nonfiction as a kid. I loved television, really bad TV, like Saved by the Bell and Three's Company. And my parents, fearing the worst, made a rule that we had to read 2 books a week before we were allowed to watch TV. So I became a speed reader by the age of 12 to watch Three's Company. And when I graduated from college, I knew I wanted to be a writer, locked myself in an apartment about 3 blocks from here. And I wrote 9 novels in a year. Deep, dark stories that took place in bars in New York City because I was reading Bret Easton Ellis and Jay McInerney at exactly the wrong time in my life, and that's what I thought writers write. So consequently, I was rejected by everyone in publishing. 190 rejection slips. Had them taped to my walls like a serial killer. I was even rejected by a janitor at a publishing house because I wrote a manuscript for an editor who was no longer working there, and it got thrown in the garbage, and a janitor took it out of the garbage and then rejected me. It seemed unnecessary, but went on. Eventually, I did sell a book called Threshold, which none of you ever heard of because it sold 3 copies, and they were all to people in my family. My second book was called Reaper, which was made into a TV movie called Fatal Error, which I hope none of you ever saw. It starred Antonio Sabato Jr., the underwear model, who played a surgeon, which was very believable casting. I didn't know surgeons did so many sit-ups in between each of their patients. And I remember watching the movie with my dad, who is a doctor, and there's a scene where Antonio leans over a patient's chest, and he goes, "We've got a subdural hematoma." And my dad said, "You know that's in the head, right?" And so anyways, I moved on from there, and my life changed accidentally. I was hanging out at a local bar in Boston called Crossroads. A lot of you probably know Crossroads. And there was this group of geeky MIT kids who were hanging out there, but they had tons of money, and it was all in $100 bills. And the thing is, in Boston, you never see $100 bills. In New York, you see them. In LA, you see them. In Vegas, they come out of the ATM machine. But these kids had all this money, so I went up to the main guy, and I said, "Why do you have all this money?" And he said, "Come to my apartment." And I went over to his apartment in the South End, and he points to his laundry, and in his laundry was $250,000. And I thought, okay, this guy's got to be a drug dealer, right? But he didn't seem like a drug dealer. He was a geeky kid. And he said, "Come to Vegas with me tomorrow." So I went to Vegas, and we landed. We all, him and 6 of his friends, sat in different seats, pretended they didn't know each other. And they got out, and they start pulling money out from under their clothes, and they said, "We're the MIT blackjack team." And I was blown away. This secret world was going on right in front of me, and I had no idea. And that became the movie 21. Changed my life. Everyone started pitching me stories. A few months later, I was sitting at home. I get a weird email at 2 in the morning. A kid says, "My best friend founded Facebook, and no one's ever heard of him." So that's an interesting email. I go out for a drink. In walks Eduardo Saverin. Just like the movie The Social Network, he's not quite as good looking. You know, in the movies, if you watch 21, it was the best looking group of MIT kids you've ever seen in your life. Eduardo, you know, he looks kind of like Andrew Garfield, but looks like a guy who's been kicked a few too many times. And anyways, he sits down with me and he starts the conversation by saying, "Mark Zuckerberg effed me." Can't say it in this beautiful room, but, and I said, as a journalist, "Tell me more." And that eventually became The Social Network, and I won't go into that because I got to talk about UFOs. So we get to UFOs a little while later. Basically, I'm sitting at home again, and I get a phone call from a Hollywood producer, and he says, "What do you think about UFOs?" And I think, well, it's bull, it's crazy, they're not real. And he says, "I want you to hear a story." And this is the story of a guy named Chuck Zukowski. Chuck Zukowski was a sheriff's deputy in Colorado who was investigating a cattle mutilation. Now, here on the East Coast, we don't know a lot about cattle mutilations. Turns out that since the 60s, over 10,000 cows and horses have been found lying on their left side, missing their organs, missing eyes, missing hearts, missing lungs. All of the cuts are surgical and circular. The bodies are completely drained of blood. There's no blood found at the scene. There's no pooling blood. It's a really weird phenomenon. Now, the FBI investigated this. 3 state governors got together, demanded an investigation in the 70s. 100 agents were involved. A 10-year investigation, they came to 0 conclusions. No one's ever been arrested. No one's ever had a footprint, not a single fingerprint, nothing. 10,000 cases. So Chuck is investigating a cattle mutilation, and he starts to think UFOs. He's immediately fired from the sheriff's department. And then he begins this lifelong quest to understand what's going on. He gets an RV, and he starts filling his family up into the RV and going from UFO site to UFO site. He starts to have these really weird run-ins with an aerospace company. And it sounds wild, but it's all true. There's an aerospace company called Bigelow Aerospace out of Nevada, which makes pieces for the International Space Station. Obama actually just mentioned them in his latest speech about the space race. They make the inflatable transhab that's attached to the International Space Station. They're run by Robert Bigelow, a reclusive billionaire who made his money in hotels. Turns out, for the past 35 years, they have been secretly investigating UFOs. Anytime there's a UFO sighting, Bigelow Aerospace sends a team. Nobody knows this. Now, if you look at the FAA manual that all of our pilots use, in the FAA manual, under what a pilot is supposed to do when they see something weird, they don't report it to the FAA, they don't report it to the airline, they report it to Bigelow Aerospace. It's right in the FAA manual. We have outsourced our UFO studies to a private aerospace company. Now, Chuck Zukowski was looking into all these different weird things. He starts to notice that this team is always following him around. They're investigating wherever he's investigating. It all comes to head at Roswell, as everything in the UFO world does. For those of you who don't know, Roswell is the most famous UFO setting in the world. The facts of Roswell are quite unbelievable. They actually begin a little bit earlier than the Roswell crash itself. In 1945, there was a phenomenon called the Foo Fighters. We all know the band, the Foo Fighters. Well, the word actually comes from something that was happening during World War II. American pilots and UK pilots flying over the Rhine in 1945 started to see these weird balls of fire flying alongside their planes. When they turned their planes towards the fireballs, they would disappear. It got to be such a huge phenomenon that it was on the cover of the New York Times. What are these Foo Fighters? Are they some strange German weapon? After the war, we captured all the German scientists, and we said to them, what were these fireballs? And they said, I don't know, we've been seeing them too. Turns out the Japanese were seeing them. Everyone was seeing them in 1945. Fast forward a year and a half later, 1947, in the middle of the night, an Air Force base in Roswell, New Mexico, tracked three fireballs flying through a storm. One of those fireballs crashed on a ranch, spreading 300 yards of debris. The debris was described as metallic and covered in weird hieroglyphics. The rancher called the police. The police called the Air Force. The Air Force sent a team out, gathered up the debris, and then put out an official press release that said, we have now in our possession a flying saucer. That was the Air Force press release. 3 hours later, they rescinded the press release. They then took all the debris, put it on an airplane, made a photograph of a radar engineer sitting amongst the debris of a weather balloon, and said it was actually a weather balloon. Everyone involved in that photo has since come forward and said that it was faked. The person in the photo, the photographer who took the photo, and the general who ordered the photo. It was a faked photo. The debris was moved to Area 51, where it sits to this day. For some reason, the government will not release the files on this, and we'll get to that in one more second. Chuck Zukowski, our sheriff deputy, did an archaeological dig at Roswell and found a little piece of weird metal. He found this little piece of metal, put out his own press release saying, does anyone want to help me analyze this piece of metal? Guess who contacts him? Bigelow Aerospace. They take the piece of metal, they analyze it, they send Chuck an email saying it does not match anything in the database of common materials, and then they cut off all contact with him. He can't get his metal back, and to this day, he doesn't know what happened to it. Now, the story gets weirder and weirder from there, and it is a very weird story already. But I want to end, you know, on a note that is very intriguing to me. Recently, Hillary Clinton was being interviewed on Jimmy Kimmel, of all places, and she said if she's made president, one of the things she wants to do is to get the Air Force to release their UFO files. Turns out that every president we've had has tried to get these files released. Bill Clinton tried and failed. Bush tried and failed. Reagan wanted to get them. Jimmy Carter was a big believer. We don't know about Obama. I'm guessing he probably doesn't believe, but we don't know. I'm sure Trump believes, and we haven't gotten into that yet. I don't know if Hillary was trying to get the UFO vote or not, but she was then asked afterwards, do you believe we've ever been visited? Hillary's answer was, I wouldn't be surprised. This is a woman who was in the White House, Secretary of State. She knows more than any of us, and she wouldn't be surprised. So I will just say this. Although I can't tell you whether or not UFOs have been here, I will say the impediments to believing in UFOs have fallen. We used to not believe that there was life on other planets. Now we pretty much are sure there's probably life on other planets because we're finding Earth-like planets every day. We used to think these planets are too far away. Turns out they're not. We just found one recently that is reachable by current technology in 40 years. That's really not that far. So the reasons not to believe are falling. I will leave you with one last point. The Catholic Church, and we're in a beautiful, I don't know if we, is this Catholic? I don't know. A beautiful church. The Catholic Church recently announced that if we did find life on other planets, it would not affect Catholic doctrine. Catholicism can adapt to life on other planets. I don't know why they made that statement. It seems very interesting and current. But anyways, listen, I'm ready to believe, and I hope you all are too. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Ben. Well, if Ben Mezrich's book tells us about strange things we can't identify, then Richard Russo's work deals always with characters we recognize instantly or come to know and care about as they struggle, sometimes heroically, sometimes foolishly, to keep their heads above water. And with his latest novel, Rick returns to North Bath in upstate New York with Everybody's Fool. And we would be foolish not to get in that signing line along with all the other books and after the book review and to buy this book. So please welcome Richard Russo.
For publicity reasons, the conference that brought together Bulgarian writers with Americans and Brits began and ended in the capital of Sofia. But its real work, a week's worth of workshops, lectures, and individual conferences, took place in a small resort town on the Black Sea. Thanks to a canceled flight, I had missed both orientation and the first day's events. So I was only now getting to meet my colleagues on a 5-hour bus ride to Szczopel. One of these was the American biographer Elizabeth Frank, who had done the conference before and was able to fill me in, help me to interpret what I was seeing out the bus's windows. I'd been surprised by what a vibrant city Sofia was, its cafes and coffee shops teeming with young people flush with freedom and hope after the fall of communism. In the countryside, Liz explained, things were different. Out here, many people remembered communism fondly. Maybe there had been no food in the markets, but at least back then, everybody was in the same boat, they said. Now the stores were full of food, but it was all unaffordable. So how, they wondered, was this better? Some of the Bulgarian countryside looked well-tended and prosperous, especially the vineyards. But there were long stretches of fallow, weedy poverty. The prosperity was mostly foreign investment, Liz explained, EU money pouring in, buying up everything on the cheap. At some point in our conversation, the conversation turned personal, and Liz told me a story that I would think about often in the days to come. As a little girl living with her family in New York City, she sometimes was awakened late at night by loud voices. One of them was her father's, the other his writing partner's. They were TV comedy writers. And what they were arguing about so passionately was whether a line in this week's show was or was not funny. To Liz, being awakened by the ardent bickering of her father and his partner, was both comforting and inspiring. If good writing was worth arguing over, like politics, it must be worthwhile and important. Maybe she'd be a writer one day herself. Hearing this story left me feeling strangely bereft. Because as a kid, I too had often been awakened in the middle of the night by loud voices. My mother asking my father, "What is wrong with you?" And his response, "You know what, Gene, how about you just kiss my ass?" Until one day, all that stopped because he was gone. Years later, approaching 30, when I told my father I wanted to be a writer, he didn't try to discourage me, but clearly to him, it was a puzzling ambition. In Szczopel, we writers took over a small hotel built on a bluff overlooking the Black Sea. The teaching was challenging. Many of the Bulgarians spoke some English, but for the most part, we communicated through interpreters. Mornings, the Bulgarian and English-speaking faculty and fellows each had their own writing workshops, but in the afternoon, the lectures and panels were translated, Bulgarian into English, and vice versa. And at meals, every effort was made to combine the groups so that we could get to know one another. The Bulgarians were all singers and serious drinkers. After dinner, they congregated in the hotel patio for long nights of song and cheap red wine. Not wanting to be antisocial, we Americans and Brits joined them for a while. But we had our morning workshops and afternoon talks to prepare, so one by one, we drifted away. My own room was on the third floor, its balcony overlooking the patio below, and each night I was awakened by singing that became more boisterous as the hours lengthened. Bulgarian folk songs came first, but at some point, the singers segued into American rock and pop. They seemed to have a special fondness for Bon Jovi. And that first night, when I heard them bellowing, "Oh, we're halfway there, oh, living on a prayer, wah, 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 wah." I went onto the balcony and peered down into the dark, thinking that the other Americans and Brits must have rejoined them, but no. The singers were all Bulgarian. Was that how it seemed to them, one brief generation after the fall of communism, that they were halfway there? Was that how it felt as artists searching for their voices after decades of enforced silence? One thing was for sure. None of the singers in that courtyard had ever been awakened in the middle of the night by parents arguing over whether something was or was not funny. I suspected that their fathers were more like mine than Liz Frank's. They wouldn't want to stand in the way of their kids' dreams, but neither would they understand why, with so many needful things in the world, their sons and daughters would want to tell stories, write poems, paint pictures. Like any other instrument, the human voice needs to be used. What do you say if you haven't spoken all day, or all week, or all year? What if you haven't been allowed a voice your entire life? What if the same were true of your parents, your grandparents? Would everything that you had been wanting to say for so long come gushing out? Probably not. Or so it seemed with my Bulgarian writers whose manuscripts I now read in translation. Most of them seemed talented, and yes, anxious to enter the literary conversation from which they had been so long excluded. They wanted not just to write, but to start magazines and publishing houses for their stories and poems to appear in. They all wanted these things, they wanted all of these things at once, but again, how? Do you go directly to the big subject? What life was like under totalitarian rule? If so, how should that subject be treated? As serious drama? As satire? Or are you allowed to forget all that? Are you allowed to be happy? Devout? Sure, now you can say anything you want, but what should you say first? These seem to be the unspoken questions lurking behind these Bulgarian manuscripts. Or, to put it another way, how do you learn to sing alone on the page in the light of day like you do collectively at night at the edge of the Black Sea? Where do you find the confidence necessary to birth a voice uniquely your own? Halfway there? Perhaps, but isn't it also possible that you're just beginning? And here's an even more alarming thought. What if there's no you yet? What if your writerly identity has to be invented before speech is even possible? Consider a writer like Kenneth Millar, who grew up in Canada, moved to Southern California, and there invented Ross McDonald, who in turn invented Detective Lou Archer, as well as the city of Santa Teresa, his fictional Santa Barbara. More than anything, it was Archer's tough, world-weary voice that anchored those brilliant detective novels. But to read McDonald's dazzling correspondence with Eudora Welty is to understand that while Archer's voice might be McDonald's, it definitely was not Millar's. Ken Millar was no wisecracking tough guy. The voice we hear in his letters to Welty is educated, intellectual, sensitive, at times almost effete. The soft, quiet voice of the birdwatcher that Ken Millar was. It's the voice of a man whose experience of life could not have been more further removed from that of his detective hero. As a young writer, I remember vividly trying to achieve just such a metamorphosis in my own writing program in Arizona, a place as far away from my home in upstate New York as Millar's was from his native Ontario. Though I would have loved to write books like McDonald's and even tried my hand at detective stories, such a radical metamorphosis simply was not possible for me. In the end, I had little choice but to return, imaginatively at least, to my heart's home and be who I was, who I had always been. It appeared who I was meant to be. I had inherited an out-of-the-way patch of dirt about the size of Faulkner's, and I had to find a way to be content with that. But at the time, my inability to invent a new, improved self felt like nothing so much as defeat. But what of my Bulgarians? Who should they be? Should they recognize and embrace their limitations as I had done? Or bravely toss those shackles off as Ken Millar had somehow managed to do? This was what they seemed to want me to tell them, who they were, what they should love, what they should value most, how to get from where they were to where I was. And so, each night, I carefully read their manuscripts, looking for clues to their identities. And every night in the courtyard below, they sang, first the unknowable songs of their country, and then the songs of mine. Night after night, they insisted they were halfway there. In the run-up to the conference, I had been sent a questionnaire by the producer of a television talk show that I was to appear on when we returned to Sofia. They had a copy of my most recent book, but they wanted background information on its author. Who and what were my cultural influences? Could I list some of my favorite books, artists, musicians? I mentioned Dickens and Twain and the paintings of Edward Hopper and Springsteen, of course. One of the benefits of having been a teacher for so long is that I seldom get nervous about public appearances, though I was a bit anxious about this one. It was live TV, and I was to be the last guest on a 90-minute show, which meant that any anxiety I might be feeling would intensify as I watched from the wings. And of course, I would again be working with an interpreter, and nothing is more likely to be lost in translation than humor, my strong suit. Never mind, I told myself, what happens in Bulgaria stays in Bulgaria. The program was clearly modeled on American and British talk shows. Its host, an attractive woman who was seated at the center of a horseshoe-shaped piano bar. Her cohort, combining the duties of Ed McMahon and Doc Severinsen, was a young fellow at the piano, with whom the host would sometimes banter, though mostly he just noodled at the keyboard as she talked with her guests, all of whom entered the studio, I kid you not, through a haze of dry ice smoke. When it was my turn, I climbed aboard my seat at the piano bar, and my interpreter nestled up next to me, whispering the host's first question in my ear, something about how it had felt to win the Pulitzer Prize, and my heart leapt with gratitude. I knew the answer to this question. Not in Bulgarian, of course, but still. I had been warned to keep my answer short, a challenge for me. I like long answers, in part because they keep the next question, which you may not know the answer to, at bay. But guess what? I knew the answer to that one as well, so I gave it confidently, even risking a mild witticism, at which the host threw back her head and laughed, and the pianist did a comic little arpeggio on the keyboard. I was a hit. Even on the other side of the world, I was a funny guy. More questions, more answers, more noodling at the piano. At some point, I became aware of movement in my peripheral vision and noticed that the other guests were glancing in the direction of whatever was going on behind me. Was it my imagination, or had the noodling, atonal a moment before, begun to resolve itself into a medley, to a melody? What was it? Stay focused, I told myself. My segment couldn't have more than 3 or 4 more minutes left. Apparently, I was going to survive. Indeed, the host was now grinning at me like she meant to award me a second Pulitzer Prize right there. Doom, doom, doom. I knew that tune. What was it? Well, Richard Russo, said the English voice in my ear, we understand that you're a fan of Bruce Springsteen, who is very popular here in Bulgaria. So this is our way of saying, welcome to Sofia, and please do come again. Rotating on my seat, I saw that a bassist, a guitar player, and a drummer had joined the pianist, and one by one, they joined in. When the guitarist stepped up to the mic, I heard the lyric in my brain a split second before the singer's voice reached my ear. Grab your ticket and your suitcase, thunder's rolling down the track. You don't know where you're going now, but you know you won't be back. Well, darling, if you're weary, lay your head upon my chest. We'll take what we can carry and leave behind the rest. The singer had a pretty good voice. Not like Bruce's, of course, but not bad. What I couldn't tell was whether the English words were being sung phonetically or if the singer actually understood them. This strain carries saints and sinners. This train carries losers and winners. This train carries whores and gamblers. This train carries lost souls. Did the singer comprehend that he was singing a great American anthem, maybe the greatest written in my lifetime, by the finest storytelling songwriter of his generation? Did he understand that it was Springsteen's voice that had helped an exhausted nation through Vietnam, the AIDS epidemic, the attack on the World Trade Center? Somehow, the possibility that the singer didn't know the meaning of the words he was mouthing caused my own throat to close up dangerously. Big wheels roll like fields through your sunlight streams. Meet me in the land of hope and dreams. Dear God, I thought, I am about to break down sobbing on Bulgarian television. And if I do, this will not stay in Bulgaria. I said, this train, dreams will not be thwarted, this train, faith will be rewarded, this train, steel wheels singing, this train, bells of freedom ringing. I'll draw the curtain here and leave it to your imaginations to decide whether I maintain some semblance of dignity and decorum, or whether I wept like a child on the far side of the world, wept for pride in Bruce, for the nation that had spawned him. And I felt a welling up of pride, too, for every singer, poet, and artist who has ever been lucky enough to find his voice and the courage to raise it, as well as heartbreaking empathy for the many who have tried and failed. And yes, yes, profound admiration for my Bulgarians who sang and drank the night away in the belief that they were halfway there, which you have to believe or you'll never catch that train, the one carrying saints and sinners and lost souls, the one headed for the land of hope and literary dreams, which is neither here nor there, but rather in each of us who chase it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Well, I think I have to quote Richard Russo back to him and say, the singer was pretty good. Thank you so much, Richard Russo. And now, in honor of Faith Saley's regular appearances on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, I feel I should introduce her by summing up her memoir, Approval Junkie, in the form of a listener limerick challenge. You are all BUR listeners. You know the rules. So, approval was always Faith's game. If she got no applause, it was lame. But she kicked her fame habit, and as luck would have it, she got the acclaim just the... Please welcome Faith Saley.
I think I have to text Bill Curtis and get him to record your voicemail. I'm going to resist the lure of the pulpit and go rogue here, although I do have to say it is so nice to celebrate books in a place of worship, isn't it? As Anne said, books give us faith, and they are magical and transcendent. Although I was raised Catholic, and I do not think a Catholic church would let me tell my story on the altar without a lot of genuflecting. So God help me, here's my story. When I graduated from North Springs High School, home of the Spartans in Atlanta, Georgia, the most famous alumnus was one John Schneider. AKA, oh, you know who it is. It's Bo Duke from the Dukes of Hazzard. Now, more recent notable grads include Usher and Raven Simone. And you can decide for yourself who's more famous based on, you know, your appreciation of R&B versus a bizarrely silent accent aigu. Laughter from the people who took French. Thank you. Now, I myself am famous among certain circles, if you can make a circle out of three people, and those three would be my dad, my dad's accountant, who kindly asked for updates on my career, and the one Star Trek Uber fan who possesses the collectible trading card of me as genetically enhanced mutant Serena Douglas. Thank you. That is an applause. Is that applause from a Deep Space Nine fan? Yeah. I will say this about all those North Springs celebrities who were way starrier than I. None of them was crowned Miss Aphrodite. Now that my old high school is a charter school and we're in the 21st century, I think it's safe to assume that they have shut down the beauty and talent pageant that marked the highlight of my time as a Spartan. And if y'all are shocked that a public high school held a pageant for its girls every spring, then probably your people were on the chilly side of the war of northern aggression. Becoming Miss Aphrodite was one of my goals as soon as I got to North Springs freshman year. My mandate to make straight A's included an A for Aphrodite. Now, I was in classes with mostly the same kids all day long. Oh, you want to see? Thank you. This man is saying move over there because you want to see me. I love you. Thank you. So I was in classes with mostly the same kids all day long, and they had names like Shira Levine, Greg Kaplan, Alfred Chang. You see where I'm going? We were the honor students. And as soon as the bell rang at the end of the day, I rushed away from school to activities that required character shoes and emphatically splayed fingers that a Philistine might deride as jazz hands. I was building a very serious professional career by doing touring kids' musicals and public service announcements and commercials for Six Flags Over Georgia. In other words, I didn't hang out with my fellow Spartans much, but girls with names like Romney Ramsey and Kelly Crump, and those are real names, and it was Kelly with an I, they were cheerleaders or on the drill team, and they hung out with each other and bonded at practice or on the football field, which was officially named Thermopylae Stadium. Now, North Springs did not have a classics department, which might explain why our stadium was named after a battle in which the Spartans fought valiantly but were ultimately routed. The yearbook was the Phalanx, and the high school paper was the Oracle, and my spiral perm was Medusa. What I'm trying to say is I didn't feel like the kids at North Springs knew what I could do. I needed to show them how well I over-emoted and belted. I needed to be Miss Afro. Now, I knew just enough Greek mythology to know that Aphrodite was the goddess of beauty and love. And you know what? Love I wasn't after. I had love. I had parents who loved me. I had a gay brother who loved me and a straight brother who tolerated me. And boyfriends who'd said they'd love me and gone on to college. And as a fresh person and sophomore and junior, you know, I went on some dates and a couple of proms. By the time I got to senior year, love could wait. Because having a boyfriend seemed like a distraction from my real goal, which was beauty. I had a new definition of beauty. Beauty to me, by senior year, was losing so much weight that people pointed and stared, that I could wear anything, that I was a fat-free product. Beauty meant I finally looked like a dancer, a triple threat, even though my threat level was probably like 2.25. Beauty was the makeover I'd given myself. And probably anyone who saw me saw bones much more than beauty. I finally liked what I saw in the mirror. Or rather, what I didn't see, all that flesh that I'd disappeared. I remember learning as a teenager that Michelangelo used to see his statues in the marble, and he would carve until he set them free. And just shy of my 18th birthday, I felt triumphant that I had chiseled myself into an angular work of art. Art that I thought needed to be on display in the school gymnasium. So, I understood that you had to be a senior to win Miss Aphrodite. Now, I knew I could compete as a freshman, but I had to pay my dues. You had to get a club to sponsor you, and I always got the French club, which wasn't hard because I don't think anybody else in the club wanted to compete, but I preferred to think that the club recognized my je ne sais quoi that I was about to unleash in the school gymnasium. I was very, it's hard to concentrate when I'm seeing myself as a mutant up there. I was very pleased with my first pageant because I placed first runner-up. Now, I sort of chalk up my near miss to two things. One was my pandering answer during the interview portion, and two was my cobalt blue unitard. It's very hard to compete with spandex, but it's very easy to compete in it, my friends, especially when you add a bright red dance bottoms that give you a wedgie while you're trying to sing Nothing from a chorus line. Yeah, a chorus line, as you may well know, is a song for Morales, who is a Latina character, and I am the whitest person on earth, but I sang the shit out of that song, which is easy to do since if you've ever heard it, it's mostly kind of spoken. The judges would choose five of us to move on to the interview round. Now, you could qualify to judge Miss Aphrodite if you did something like ran a real estate company or predicted the weather on a local station or held the title of Mrs. Peachtree City, 1983. And I had already decided that no matter what the question was, my answer was going to be Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Now, this seemed to be clutch in Atlanta in the 80s when the city's slogan was the catchy Atlanta, the city too busy to hate. That was the real slogan. This goes over better in Atlanta. It's okay to laugh. It's okay to laugh. And it just so happened that my answer lined up stunningly with the question, which was, what person do you admire most? And now, I did genuinely admire what I knew of MLK at that point in my life, but honestly, the most truthful answer when I was 14 would have been Molly Ringwald, because she is awesome and then some. You may be wondering about the competition. It was stiff. Stiff as in awkward and self-conscious. Just as Sparta was a military city-state not known for its arts, North Springs High School circa 86, 89 was not known for its performers. You really had to be creative in your mediocrity in order to stand out. So Wendy Terratute sang the entire song of the Rose with one hand mysteriously behind her back until she whipped it out at the end to demonstrate she'd been holding a rose. Lies the seed that with the sun's love in the spring becomes the rose. Melissa Terrell sang Your Cheatin' Heart and dedicated it to her dad. Laura Deegee came out in jodhpurs, and she rolled a TV behind her and with a VHS player, and for her talent, she hit play and treated us to a video of her riding her horse, possibly breaking her hymen, to the love theme from St. Elmo's Fire. There's someone in the second row covering his eyes because I just said hymen in a church. I know. I know. This is irreverence. I'm sorry. Sophomore year, it was a wash. I didn't even get to the interview round. I sang a plaintive song about being a lion tamer in a salmon-colored leotardy dress with rhinestones all over it. So here's a pageant tip from me to you. Never choose a song from a forgettable 70s musical starring Doug Henning for your pageant. I was so disturbed by the judge's blindness to my sparkly talent that I went home right after the pageant and ate an entire Domino's pizza with my boyfriend, Brendan. Junior year, I got my groove back. I got a lot of things back. I got a big butt, I had big hair, I had big boobs. But you know what? I kind of owned it in a Delta Burke kind of way. You remember her? Designing Women? That's some plus-size goodness. And I upped my game with a Liza Minnelli song, which I didn't sing it. I sold it in the direction of the local meteorologist as if to say, that's Liza with a Z, a-hole. And I sailed through the interview round without even relying on slain African-American icons, and I tied for first runner-up. By senior year, the stakes were high, at least as high as my hair. Did you guys build your hair that high up in Boston, too, back in the day? Okay, good. It was my final chance for what I saw as closure on my high school career, the cherry on top of the crown on top of my head. I wanted to leave North Springs, but I didn't want to go without leaving my mark. And you know, on a date, I wouldn't go farther than second base. But I was on a macro trajectory out of that school, that town, that South. I fantasized about lacing up L.L. Bean duck boots and trudging through the stuff called snow across a 200-year-old courtyard to a class called, I don't know, Gender Empire and the Politics of Appearance. I was headed in my mind to study theater at an Ivy League school. And even though I was so eager to leave it all behind, I wanted a sash and a tiara for the departure on my grand tour. I was never too cool for school. So I was hungry for that title. I was hungry for being named valedictorian. I was hungry for acceptance to Yale. And I was hungry for food. Since the fall of my senior year, I'd lost 45 pounds. I'd spent the summer at a pre-college musical theater program, staring loathingly at myself in the mirror at dance classes that were taught by the likes of Billy Porter, who went on to win a Tony for Kinky Boots. And I returned home as resolute as Rocky, except with a high-cut leotard to do aerobics instead of a hoodie for stadium stair climbing. That's what I looked like. And although my daughter will probably hear this story someday, and I should present myself as a dangerous cautionary tale for an after-school special, I felt that last time as I vied for Miss Aphrodite that I was already a winner. I was thin it to win it, which is why I turned to Valerie Kennedy. Vocal coach Valerie Kennedy was the Bella Caroli of pageant hopefuls. She could take your voice and assign you the perfect song and a few key moves and turn you into Miss Anything. Her secret weapon were these long spoons. Do you have Dairy Queen up here? Yes, long spoons. I know it's like friendly. Is it like a big Friendly's Dairy Queen rivalry? Okay. So we had Dairy Queen, and they have these long spoons for blizzards. And she would make you sort of put them down your throat to maintain ideal palate placement while you sang. Now, luckily, I was anorexic and not bulimic, so this worked really well. What also worked really well was Valerie's very keen choice of song for me. Barbara Streisand's Let's Hear It For Me from Funny Lady.
So applaud it and cheer it, come on now. Let's hear it for me.
It's a terrible song. It's terrible. If terrible means kick ass because you want to win your senior year pageant. Now, to ensure I stuck the landing, Valerie taught me her signature pageant arm raise, okay? So please imagine this, and while you do so, picture me in, I have like crunchy curls on top of my head, and I'm wearing black patent leather pumps, and my bony body is sporting this rainbow sequin micro mini that I had bought from the Avon catalog. And I'm standing in the middle of the stage, and for the last note of the song, I turn to my right, and the microphone's in my left hand. That's a downstage hand for all you theater geeks out there. And my right hand, upstage, is poised, ready for action. And on the very last note of the song that I'm wailing, I crouch down delicately on my stiletto heels, and I slowly rise while simultaneously raising my outstretched right hand from 6 o'clock to effing high noon. And as I do this, I follow with my head the entire time the glorious pageant arm, so that as my right hand is stretched up to the sky, I am looking up to the Lord. And then I, at the end of it all, after I've held that note to queendom come, I yank that arm down dramatically to demonstrate that I have exhausted myself, that I have given you all of me right there on that gym stage, leaving you no choice, kids, but to hear it for me. So I think I need to demonstrate that. Let's hear it for me. I guess I don't have to tell you that it worked. I mean, not to brag or anything, but no one stood a chance against my emaciated, spastic resolve. High school obsessions seem so important at the time. The yearbooks full of senior superlatives, you know, best legs, best dressed, best smile. I still have my tiara. It is missing a few stones and a comb right here to shove into my aqua net nest. But I am like a Tennessee Williams character, desperately clinging to the symbol of my salad days. Like, literally just salad, y'all, dressing on the side. About a week after I won, I received rejection letters from all the Ivies. Jennifer Lindy was named valedictorian, and on prom night, my dad took me out to dinner because no one had asked me. But for one brief shining moment, the Greek gods had welcomed me in their pantheon as Aphrodite, the goddess of beauty and love. I love casually telling people that I won my high school pageant. In the Northeast, in this century, it sounds positively exotic. And I faux brag about being Miss Aphrodite 1989 because it is ridiculous. But the truth is, I have a kind of wistfulness about it, because I remember it clearly as one of the last times that I set goals to dominate my body and captivate the student body, certain that I could achieve them through sheer determination. And that's a faith that belongs to the young, because you learn soon enough that life doesn't always work that way, and wishing hard and working hard don't always stick a crown across atop your ephemerally skinny body. Thank you.
That was awesome. Oh, they're running for the exits.